The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 85-2079, Laborers' Health and Welfare Trust Fund versus Advanced Lightwave Concrete Company. Mr. Roger, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether or not pension plan fiduciaries are precluded from access to federal courts to enforce continuing obligations to pay trust fund contributions because such continuing obligations are required by the National Labor Relations Act. The Court below ruled that the language of Section 515 of ERISA, which was amended in 1980 by the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, which mandates the payment of contributions under the terms of a collectively bargained agreement to the extent not inconsistent with law, did not allow such access, ruling in effect that due to the preemption doctrine, the only recourse the trustees had was to the National Labor Relations Board. This Court has previously found that federal district courts have jurisdiction to decide issues which normally arise under the National Labor Relations Act in order to effectuate other federal statutes, including ERISA. It did so in the duty of fair representation cases, such as Vaca v. Sipes. It did so in Kaiser Steel versus Mullins, where it said that defenses arising under the National Labor Relations Act could be raised in contractual enforcement claims. Likewise, it did so in Connell Construction and Plumbers, where it allowed the litigants to an antitrust claim to look to the National Labor Relations Act for guidance. It should do so in this particular case.
Has it ever done so in an unfair labor practice claim?
As such,
yes.
As an unfair labor practice claim, it has not done so. The Court below failed to read Section 515 with the same breadth that we believe is required in order to give full meaning to the congressional intent of a broad and comprehensive legislative scheme embodied in ERISA and MUPA, the purpose of which was to protect the pension benefits of many millions of workers in this country to ensure that when they came time to retire, they would have their benefits available to them. Now, when Congress passed ERISA in 1974, it in effect codified fiduciary obligations which arose under common law, and it gave to the fiduciaries of these plans the obligation to make sure that the monies were available for participants to receive their pensions and other benefits when they became due and owing. Congress recognized in 1974 there were serious problems in enforcing the obligations of employers to contribute. And Congress learned, unfortunately, between 1974 and 1980, that what they thought was mandated in a very broad statute in 1974 just wasn't enough. And so in 1980, they passed the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act of 1980. They did so for several reasons. First of all, they realized that because of the litigation arena out there, employers were able to use the processes to avoid paying their obligations, thus putting at great financial risk the pension plans and other plans that were required to receive contributions in order to pay out the benefits. And secondly, they created a situation to force employers who withdrew from plans to pay their fair share of withdrawal liability in the circumstance where they chose to withdraw or were forced to withdraw. Thus, we had, with the passage of the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, the creation of two new statutory schemes. We had the creation of Section 515, which is worded in the form, every employer who is obligated under the terms of a collectively bargained agreement, must, to the extent not inconsistent with law, meet and pay such obligations. It also created, in the unfunded withdrawal liability sections, the obligation of employers to pay their fair share under the circumstances where an employer permanently ceased to have an obligation to make those contributions. What we are really dealing with here today is a situation where in one case Congress used words under one form and where in the other section they use words under the other. In Section 515, the wording is under the terms of a collectively bargained agreement. In Section 4212, they talk about the result of being party to one or more agreements or as a result of a duty arising under labor management relations law. We don't think the situation is inconsistent. Withdrawal liability is a special circumstance, and it requires a finding that there must be a permanent cessation of the obligation to contribute. The mere impasse in a labor relations context, the mere failure to pay one's bills, the mere existence of a labor dispute does not in itself create a permanent obligation or cessation of obligation to contribute. In Section 515, however, because of what Congress recognized was the increasing problems of employers failing to pay their bills as they were, they use different words. They use the words, the terms of a collectively bargained agreement. Now, the court below stated that those words were not sufficient to overcome what they deemed to be the basic preemption doctrine. We suggest that that is too narrow a reading of Section 515. The terms of a collectively bargained agreement does not mean a collective bargaining agreement. It means the source from which the terms arose, the definition of the terms. Now, we have a situation in the labor management relations field, and we must remember that the Act of 1980 really deals with collective bargaining in the collective bargaining arena, not just some theoretical situation where employers...
I think the obligation to pay in this case arises from the labor law, not from ERISA.
The initial obligation arose from the fact that Advanced Lightweight was party to a collective bargaining agreement, which it chose to terminate by giving notice to the union, and which did not pay those contributions after the termination date of the contract before anything else happened. We are dealing with a period of time between an expiration date of a contract and that period where either a new contract is entered into or impasse is reached.
And the obligation then, that the employer's obligation, if there was bargaining the impasse, his obligation would cease.
Once impasse is reached.
Yes, yes.
And that the definition of impasse is up in the air at this point. Once impasse is reached, up until then he owes the money. Absolutely.
But it's an unfair labor practice only, isn't it, after the contract has expired?
It is clearly up until Section 515 of ERISA, an unfair labor practice, enforceable before the National Labor Relations Board. But we must point out, Chief Justice, that the interpretation given to Section 8A5 and 8D is one which this Court gave in NLRB versus Katz. It said that in order to effectuate the purposes of the National Labor Relations Act, we must hold, that an employer whose contract has expired must continue in full force and effect terms and conditions of employment, including the payment of trust fund contributions.
So the obligation after he terminates is an obligation pursuant to the terms of the contract. The obligation after he terminates and before he's bargained to impasse, that obligation is pursuant to the terms of the contract, but it is not a contractual obligation. It's an obligation under the labor laws.
That's correct, Your Honor. The obligation doesn't necessarily require the existence of a collective bargaining agreement to become extant.
Agreement's done. It's gone.
The agreement terminated. Has terminated. It has
Awfully
expired.
Terminated. Right.
But the obligation continues. And this is not a situation where we're dealing...
Is the obligation continue, as you described, as a continuing obligation, or is it a new obligation that arises?
I believe it is a continuing obligation under the labor laws, Your Honor. I believe that under NLRB...
One's a contractual obligation, the other's a labor law obligation, you say that they're continuing.
When one negotiates a collective bargaining agreement in today's economy, one does so in the context of the laws which we know exist. And I must point out that the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act specifically deals with obligations which initially arise pursuant to collective bargaining, the collective bargaining process. Knowing that that is the arena of this war, as it were, parties to collective bargaining agreements know that the mere expiration date of their contract does not end their obligations. Those obligations continue under law. Now, that law happened to be interpretations of the National Labor Relations Act.
Would it not at least be theoretically possible that during the period between the giving of the notice saying I intend to terminate my relations with the union at the end of the contract period. There's some bargaining went on as to the possibility of renewal, and before the date arises, they reach an impasse and find out they won't be able to continue. That could
happen. Well, that not only could happen, Your Honor, it is a situation which exactly does happen, and actually under Section 8D of the Act, Congress by statute said that when you give your notice 60 days prior to the expiration date of the contract, you must statutorily maintain all terms and conditions in effect for at least a 60-day term or the expiration date of the contract, whichever occurs later. Now, the situation which we have before us may include that, but it doesn't necessarily preclude the other situation where employers and unions representing employers have contracts expire by virtue of their dates, have given notice that they intend to have a new contract negotiated, go through the process of negotiating contracts, sometimes for many, many months, and then negotiate a new contract. All the time, the employers are continuing to contribute into the trust funds because the obligation has continued. The participants and the workers and beneficiaries are entitled to their benefits. And then when the impasse is reached or a new contract is then arrived at, the definition of what the terms of the collectively bargained agreement under Section 515 becomes applicable. Conceivably, the impasse will say there will be no further trust fund contributions. Another alternative will be there will be a different form of trust fund contributions or a different date upon which they may be due. But until that point in time arises, trustees, the fiduciaries, who are not in any position to know because they are not direct participants in the collective bargaining process. Indeed, in the plans that are before the court today, you are dealing with many thousands of employers over a very large geographical area, and there's no reason to assume or even hope to assume that the trustees will have any idea that the parties to the contract have either given notice of a desire to terminate or have the contract expire or have engaged in collective bargaining or have any closer to impasse.
That the plaintiffs in this litigation are probably the worst people in the world to litigate the issue of whether the bargaining has reached an impasse or not.
They may be in the position, as you suggest, of not being able to determine an impasse, but we suggest a district court has the full power to determine an impasse. And in fact, under the Multi-Employer Pension Plan Amendments Act, Congress said that it's up to the federal district court to determine that in those circumstances where they must assess withdrawal liability.
Yes, but they do it in an adversary proceeding in which the complaining party doesn't know much about the issue, according to your description.
Well, in the withdrawal liability situation, in fact, Justice, they must attempt to arbitrate that issue before it ever gets before a district court. It is only when one of the parties, specifically the withdrawing employer, refuses to participate in the arbitration process that the trustees are then forced to go into district court to enforce that obligation.
That may be true. The withdrawal liability situation is a little different because it's not an unfair labor practice situation. But in the cases we're dealing with, you're suggesting that the trustees have to initiate this litigation even though they really don't know the facts or don't know much about the legal issues that may be dispositive.
It is entirely possible and in many cases probable that the trustees must institute litigation to collect on contributions which they believe to be due and owing because of the passage of time. Trustees, in a situation such as the facts before this case, and admittedly we are on a very minimal record in this case because it went up on summary judgment, the contract expired on June 16, 1983. The trustees would not even be in a position to know until approximately a month later whether or not that employer has allowed the contract to expire, has simply decided not to pay his bill that month, or whether or not that employer, in fact, paid through the balance of the month of June, because the bills are paid monthly. The trustees don't know until that bill is not paid or a report is not made. Now, the trustees are not in a position to act as collective bargaining parties. This Court has said on many occasions, trustees of multi-employer plans are not the parties to the contract, are not responsible, and should not allow the parties to the contract to determine their responsibilities. Rather, Congress has mandated under Section 404A that the trustees have the responsibility to ensure that these funds flow in order to ensure that the benefits will be available when these persons have to have them.
So they just have to assume all the time, you're saying, that there has not been bargaining to an impasse and bring suit. Is that?
They must assume until somebody tells them, specifically to the parties of the contract, that A, there is an impasse, and B, that a new contract has been arrived at. Unfortunately, however, we have a very broad spectrum between that phrase, new contract, and impasse. Ironically, in the time cases, which are cited in the respondents' briefs, we have what were almost two and a half year periods of time between the cessation of the contributions, the termination or expiration date of the contract, coupled with the question of whether or not there had been a withdrawal for purposes of assessment of withdrawal liability. And we had the court saying to us, the mere fact that there was a strike for almost 2.5 years, no contributions coming in for almost 2.5 years, and no abandonment of the strike does not mean that there's been a permanent withdrawal or cessation of the obligation to contribute. Indeed, impasse in itself is not a permanent cessation of the obligation.
Roger, what would be your position if a charge had been filed, if the general counsel didn't the general counsel turn down?
In one of these particular cases, Your Honor, the general counsel turned down a charge filed by one of the unions
suppose that the only charge that was involved here wasn't turned down by the general counsel, but it was filed, and there was a proceeding underway. Do you think that the federal court, at your behest, should undertake to...
In that circumstance, Justice, we know that the National Labor Relations Board, by its own rules and by law, is limited in the kind of remedies it can give. Whether or not a federal district court, under those circumstances,
it is the business of the labor board to decide whether there's been bargaining the impasse.
It is the decision of the labor board to make a decision as to whether impasse has been reached.
Exactly. And suppose the labor board had decided that there had been bargaining the impasse.
If the board had made a finding of fact that impasse had been reached and the trustees
and would that bind the federal court?
The federal court generally will defer to the board.
Defer? I didn't ask you that. Do you think legally it would be bound legally?
If we're dealing with a contribution obligation as opposed to withdrawal liability obligation, I think the federal court would certainly have to defer to a finding by the National Labor Relations Board. As opposed to a general counsel determination that there is no case.
I take it the so-called preemption argument in here is just the business of interfering with the labor board's exclusive jurisdiction to decide unfair labor practices.
That's it exactly, Justice.
And the general counsel in one of these cases turned down a charge?
Not over the failure to make contributions. They turned down a charge over a different issue. They turned down a charge over the failure to give information that the union had requested in order to collectively.
The union has never asked, never complained to the board about these contributions?
This has not been filed by the union. Nor have the trustees filed a charge, Your Honor.
What if they had? Could you?
Could I as a individual? Yes. Could the trustees have done so? Yes. Whether the trustees should be required to do so is really the issue. Because the remedies that the board allows are not the same remedies that ERISA allows. We do not get the mandatory.
That may be so, but the
fact paid through the balance of the month of June, because the bills are paid monthly. The trustees don't know until that bill is not paid or a report is not made. Now, the trustees are not in a position to act as collective bargaining parties. This court has said on many occasions, trustees of multi-employer plans are not the parties to the contract, are not responsible and should not allow the parties to the contract to determine their responsibilities. Rather, Congress has mandated under Section 404A that the trustees have the responsibility to ensure that these funds flow in order to ensure that the benefits will be available when these persons have to have them.
So they just have to assume all the time, you're saying, that there has not been bargaining to an impasse and bring suit. Is that?
They must assume until somebody tells them, specifically to the parties of the contract, that A, there is an impasse, and B, that a new contract has been arrived at. Unfortunately, however, we have a very broad spectrum between that phrase, new contract, and impasse. Ironically, in the time cases, which are cited in the respondents' briefs, we have what were almost two and a half year periods of time between the cessation of the contributions, the termination or expiration date of the contract, coupled with the question of whether or not there had been a withdrawal for purposes of assessment of withdrawal liability, and we had the court saying to us the mere fact that there was a strike for almost 2.5 years, no contributions coming in for almost 2.5 years, and no abandonment of the strike does not mean that there's been a permanent withdrawal or cessation of the obligation to contribute. Indeed, impasse in itself is not a permanent cessation of the obligation.
Roger, what would be your position if a charge had been filed, if the general counsel had
whatever source to make these contributions? The federal district courts have jurisdiction on a claim made by the trustees to get the payment of those contributions, save and except that one situation between the time of the expiration date of the contract and prior to an impasse or a new contract being reached. And we submit that under the broad scope of what Congress intended in ERISA and MUPA, to make the trustees or preclude the trustees from being able to seek federal district court relief under that circumstance is a narrow misreading of the law, and that for those reasons, we think the court below should be reversed.
Thank you, Mr. Roger. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Wallace.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. I would like first, if I may, to differ with an answer that was given to the Chief Justice. The first case that we cite on page 11 of our brief, Local 20 of the Teamsters against Morton, is a case in which this court upheld federal court jurisdiction when authorized by Congress in another statute to determine an unfair labor practice question. And the same determination was later upheld in a case not cited in any of the briefs, a case of 5 or 6 years ago, called Allied Lines against the Longshoremen's Union, which was also a question of a violation of 8B4 of the National Labor Relations Act, a damages suit for secondary activity in violation of the National Labor Relations Act. That was when the longshoremen were refusing to unload cargo from Russia as a protest against what was going on in Afghanistan. The second point I would like to make in supporting the position we have taken in a brief signed by the General Counsel of the Labor Board, as well as the Solicitor General and the Department of Labor, is that it is quite clear on the face of the very provision at issue that, and it is set forth toward the end of the appendices to the petition for certiorari, page D18. The provision at issue is toward the top of page D18 in the appendix, that Congress did not, on the face of this provision, reserve to the National Labor Relations Board exclusive authority to determine whether a violation of the National Labor Relations Act has given rise to a continuing liability to make contributions, because if the terms of the contribution plan were to specify that the employer is obligated to continue making his contributions so long as he has a duty under the contract itself or under any law referring to the contract to make those payments, then there could be no doubt on the face of the statute that there would be authority to sue.
That's just rewriting the contract. It'd also be clear if they said you have to keep paying until 1999.
But this would not rewrite the collective bargaining agreement. It would be the plan itself. And a plan could be drafted or amended that way.
Either the agreement or the plan. You could also have a plan that says you've got to keep paying until 1999.
That is correct, Mr. Justice.
That's not our case.
It's not our case, but it is. Our case is whether there is some reason to think that Congress did not authorize the trustees to sue for obligations to make payments under the terms of the contract after the contract has expired. the obligation still exists to abide by the terms of the contract as a matter of law. This is a very
as a matter of not statutory law, though. In theory, is it not true that the NLRB could decide that it's not an unfair labor practice to refuse to continue the prior agreement in effect?
It could, but right. The law has.
So the arguments that are made in Mr. Rogers' brief, in particular, about how important all this was to the Congress that these funds get this money and whatnot, you're really asserting that though it was so important, Congress left it to NLRB regulations.
Well, it had been established at the time these amendments were adopted that there is a continuing obligation to abide by terms of the collective bargaining agreement after the agreement has expired.
Not even regulations, because the NLRB doesn't have very many regulations. I'm sure they don't have a reg on this. It's just NLRB decisional law, right?
That is correct.
Which could be changed.
Which could be changed, and if...
And Congress left that all, was content to do that under ERISA.
Well, in applying provisions of the National Labor Relations Act, a district court applying this court's decision in Morton would conform its jurisprudence to the jurisprudence that's been developed by the Labor Board and by any amendment to the National Labor Relations Act that Congress might adopt. That, of course, is right.
But it's hard to argue that this was, you know, as the argument has been made, this was a matter of supreme importance to the Congress. It's purely, you know, accidental that the NLRB does it this way, as far as ERISA is concerned.
But what was of great importance to the Congress is that the trustees have a discreet, effective, unambiguous, efficacious remedy, as they said, that wouldn't be cluttered up with other issues and the defenses that were pointed to as ones that had undesirably burdened the pre-existing remedies were defenses raising other issues under the collective bargaining agreement, raising other questions of unfair labor practices, which would be very apt to be lumped in to any unfair labor practice complaint that the trustees would have to take to the board. And the general counsel would have unreviewable discretion whether to press the claim and how to settle the claim. And other issues might get much higher priority in a settlement than the trustees' desire to collect arrearages in back payments, which may seem more remote from the immediate interests of the parties to a labor dispute, and the settlement might look toward preserving labor peace and keeping people employed at the moment, which is a high priority of the National Labor Relations Act. And you would wind up with a species of the very evil that Congress had focused on in adopting the 1980 amendments, even though they didn't specifically focus on the obligation applies under the National Labor Relations Act after the expiration date of the contract. But this is something very familiar in the law. There are obligations under leases after their expiration date. They still flow from the terms of the lease. And it is a commonplace thing for people to go on working and businesses to go on in business after the expiration date of a collective bargaining agreement, while bargaining goes on, sometimes rather sporadically. And what Congress was particularly concerned about was to separate out the ability of the trustees to have an efficient remedy to keep these plans funded, to separate it out from extraneous, distracting other aspects of disputes between the parties to collective bargaining agreements. And these disputes tend to burgeon once someone takes one aspect of a labor dispute to the board. The board is not itself in a position to assume the burdens of a collection agency in exercising its discretion with respect to what cases to carry forward and how to settle the cases. Its priorities are directed toward the maintaining of labor peace and keeping the country productive.
Well, all the general counsel has to do is turn down complaints, and then I would think a federal case could go ahead.
Well, we certainly agree with that, Mr. Justice.
You just don't think the general counsel ought to be bothered.
Well, we think that Congress has provided for jurisdiction to enforce an obligation under the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, and that obligation is imposed by law. It doesn't happen to be federal contract law as such after the contract has expired. It happens to be the National Labor Relations Act. But that could be considered a term implied by law of the contract itself.
We should look at it as if the labor relations law says the contract has expired, but it hasn't.
Well, that is an implied by law term of the contract.
Well, just until impasse, the contract is still in force.
The same as a lease is extended by terms that are implied by law. That is an obligation of law. In one sense, it could be argued that no contract terms themselves impose obligations. The obligations are imposed by the law of contracts, whether there's an enforceable obligation to abide by any term of a contract.
Mr. Wallace, if we agree with you, could the employer write himself out of this holding by writing in the collective bargaining agreement and negotiating with the union a provision that says, in the event the contract is terminated, just as the obligation to pay salaries shall terminate and while the workers aren't working, so also shall the obligation to make contributions to
ERISA? We think not, because we think Congress conferred a right of the trustees to go to federal court to enforce obligations imposed by law to make payments under the terms of the contract.
But it wouldn't, there would be no obligation under the terms of the contract. So even if the National Labor Relations Board does continue the contract would not contain those terms.
Well, I don't know the answer to that. We haven't focused on that question. I rather doubt that that could be accomplished.
Thank you, Mr. Wallace. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Ross.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, the issue presented here is whether an employer's failure to contribute to a trust fund after expiration of a collective bargaining agreement, an alleged violation of Section 8A5, is actionable under ERISA Section 515, or whether such alleged violations fall within the exclusive jurisdiction of the National Labor Relations Act. Now, violation of Section 8A5 is an unfair labor practice falling within the primary jurisdiction of the NLRB, and it is axiomatic that courts are without jurisdiction over such violations. I say it's axiomatic because there have been a few rare exceptions in which this Court has permitted courts to deal with labor law issues, but generally speaking, those have been in two very discrete situations, one in which there was express statutory authority for the federal court to do so, such as in Section 303 of the Labor Management Relations Act, which was an issue in the Morton's case, or where it was a collateral issue, and it was necessary to do so in order to decide issues arising under other federal statutes.
What about in this situation if the general counsel declines to pursue the matter?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
What about a case like this one if the general counsel declines to pursue the matter for the NLRB? Should there be no federal cause of action then by the trustees?
Well, I can't speak to whether there should be. I don't believe that 515 creates such a cause
of action.
You
don't think even in those circumstances
I do
that
not
a
believe
suit could be filed?
I do not believe so, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the general counsel presumably would decide to dismiss the charge or refuse to issue a complaint on that charge because the general counsel found that the charge was without any basis in fact or there was insufficient evidence to support the charge. It would be an administrative determination that the prosecutorial body charged with enforcing the National Labor Relations Act found that there was no violation of the Act. And if there is no violation of the Act, it follows that there would be no obligation to continue contributions within the meaning
of
Section
8A5. Well, I suppose the general counsel's discretion goes beyond that, though. There may be some element of prosecutorial discretion there that doesn't go to the merits.
Well, Your Honor, I would grant you that there are some rare occasions where that prosecutorial discretion does exist, but they are rare and highly infrequent.
If you're right, then the employer would just get a complete windfall.
Well, I can't think of an instance in which that prosecutorial discretion would exist, except in that limited instance where the employer was not so large or substantial as to satisfy the administrative requirements for exercise of the board's jurisdiction. Other than that, the only thing that I can think of that would prompt the general counsel to refuse to issue a complaint would be a decision by the investigative branch of the general counsel that there was not sufficient evidence to support the charge. And that would be an administrative determination that the employer did not violate Section 8A5 and that there was no violation of the Act, and therefore there would be no obligation to continue contributions to the trust funds. I was remarking before that the other instance in which the court has allowed the district courts to decide labor law issues dealt with the instance where you had a collateral federal labor issue arising in the context of enforcement of an independent federal statute. That is what happened in the Connell case. Of course, here that is not what we're dealing with. What we're dealing with here is a claim that is grounded solely upon a Section 8A5 violation. The Solicitor General and the trust funds all agree that this entire claim is predicated on Section 8A5 and the way that that statute has been enforced by and interpreted by the National Labor Relations Board. Therefore, what we're dealing with here is an issue of federal labor law that is core to the issue before the court, and we're not dealing here with collateral federal labor issues. The federal labor issues in this case are indeed core to this case. Now, of course, that analysis changes if Section 515 was intended to reach Section 8A5 type claims, or if Congress intended Section 515 to give trust funds license to go into federal court and litigate unfair labor practices. We do not believe that Congress intended 515 to reach that result. And we say that because, contrary to the trust funds, nothing in the plain wording of Section 515 even remotely suggests that 515 was intended to reach 8A5 or to invade the NLRB's jurisdiction. 515 speaks solely of an employer's obligation to make contributions in accordance with the terms and conditions of a collectively bargained agreement. It speaks solely in terms of collective bargaining agreements and contractual obligations. And it is understandable that Section 515 speaks only in contractual terms, since by the enactment of Section 515 and its companion Section 502G2, Congress sought to give effect to an employer's contractual promise to continue ERISA funds, or to a contractual promise to contribute ERISA funds, and to eliminate.
How does an employer know he's living up to his 8A5 obligation to continue the terms of an agreement?
Well, aside from consulting a good labor lawyer, Your Honor, I believe that he would have.
Well, isn't his obligation measured by what the contractual terms were, at least?
No, Your Honor, they are not.
What are they?
They are measured by what the status quo was at the time the contract's expiration occurred.
Right. All right.
The status quo is not necessarily synonymous with what the contract provides. What I mean by that is that there are a number of provisions commonly present in collective bargaining agreements that expire with the contract's expiration, and an employer is free to discontinue because they are not deemed to be terms and conditions of employment within the
What about wages?
Now, wages are supposed to remain.
And how does the employer know he's living up to his obligation? Isn't his obligation measured by the terms of the collective bargaining contract?
No, I don't believe it is. I think his obligations are measured by what the status quo is at the time the contract expires, and the contract is an element of what that status quo is.
Well, all right. How about wages? About wages.
Wages?
Isn't he supposed to continue the wages that the collective bargaining contract calls for?
Well, as the...
At the date of expiration?
As Section 8A5 has been interpreted by the National Labor Relations Board, he is obliged to maintain the status quo until his bargaining obligation is satisfied.
What's the status quo?
The status quo is... Are the terms...
On wages. What's the status quo on wages?
Well, the status quo on wages would be that which the employer is paying at the time the contract expires.
And he's paying the wages that the collective bargaining contract requires him to pay.
If he has honored the contract, that presumably is so, Your Honor. However,
if I understand your answer correctly, your response to the question that I asked Mr. Wallace, that is whether an employer could write himself out of this problem, by simply reciting in the collective bargaining agreement that once the agreement terminates, his obligations to continue to make ERISA payments terminate.
I think
your answer to that would be that he couldn't do that because what measures his obligation under the labor laws is not the terms of the collective bargaining agreement, but what was being done at the time the agreement terminated. And at the time it terminated, regardless of what the agreement says will be the case later, at the time it terminated, he was making those ERISA payments.
Well, I believe, Your Honor, that if the collective bargaining agreement made provision for the cessation of those contributions at the contract's expiration, the contract provided that the obligation shall cease when this contract expires, I believe that the employer would be allowed to terminate those contributions.
Well, that's inconsistent with what you've just said, that the measure is the status quo.
It may appear to be so, Your Honor, but the status quo is measured by what the terms and conditions of employment are after the contract expires. If you read Section 8D of the National Labor Relations Act, you'll see that it speaks in terms of what the duty to bargain is. And that duty to bargain applies not to the terms and conditions of a collectively bargained agreement in words of 515, but instead it speaks to the terms and conditions of employment. Now, that's an important distinction that I think the Court has to keep in mind, because the terms and conditions of employment are those things which exist within the workplace when the parties are obliged to bargain. For example, as I was mentioning before, if the contract expires, the employer, as interpreted by the National Labor Relations Act, may unilaterally terminate certain things which derive solely from contracts, such things as a union security clause or dues checkoff or arbitration. On the other hand, the contract
But the duty to make contributions is a term and condition of employment, isn't it?
It has certainly been interpreted as such, Your Honor. But if the contract, in response to the question of Justice Scalia, if the contract specifically authorizes the employer to cease these contributions, the employer has satisfied his duty to bargain because he has obtained the union's agreement that the obligation will be coterminous with the expiration of the contract. One important point that I think the justices should consider in order to understand what I mean by the status quo.
Before you go any further, he could say the same thing about wages then. He could just write into the agreement, the wages I've agreed to pay will terminate at the termination of this agreement.
If the collective bargaining agreement were drafted to say that the employer's obligation to pay these wages will cease at the expiration of the contract and the employer is authorized to implement those changes which he deems appropriate after the expiration, I would agree with you. But that's not what we're talking about.
Would the National Labor Relations Board agree with me?
You'd have to ask them, but I believe that they would. I might add also, and this is one important point that I think has to be given careful thought by the Court, so you understand what I mean by the status quo. There will be a number of things which qualify as terms and conditions of employment, even though those terms and conditions of employment appear nowhere in the collective bargaining agreement. This is the law of the shop that this Court has so often spoke of. And these are things which exist independent of the contract and which represent the status of the workplace during the contract's term and the status of the workplace after the contract expires. So, for instance,
so a pension plan is part of the common law of the shop.
No, I suspect they would look at you like you're out of your mind.
Yes, exactly.
Certainly, a pension contribution is something which will be specifically mandated, but I think in order for the court to understand what I mean by the status quo, the court should recognize that there will be many things that are extra-contractual that the employer must maintain. And that is why I say it is the status quo which the NLRB gives effect to, and not the contract. And I think that is the fallacy which is fundamental to the arguments raised by both the petitioner and by the Solicitor General.
But the measure of the contribution is determined by reference to that.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
The amount and measure of the employer's duty to contribute to the plans seems to be measured by the terms of the collective bargaining agreement that's expired.
Well, certainly to the extent
that's
that
it, the point of reference, certainly.
It is, well, I think as the Ninth Circuit said, it serves as the parameters for the employer's obligation, or it is a parameter of the employer's obligation, but it ceases to survive as an operative document. And what happens in this instance is that the NLRB, in its enforcement of the National Labor Relations Act, has concluded that employers must maintain the status quo while the bargaining obligation is being satisfied. Theory being that if the employer is free to make unilateral changes while that process is in progress, he or she emasculates the collective bargaining process. And certainly that is a theory which this court adopted and endorsed in the NLRB Katz case.
Well, it ought to be enforceable somewhere, that obligation. And it's discretionary whether it will be enforced by the NLRB. The General Counsel has some discretion. And so that's the difficulty.
Well, I can understand your concern about that, although I think you have to look at the exercise of that discretion within the context of the National Labor Relations Act and the scheme created by Congress when it passed that law. It recognized that the General Counsel was going to exercise discretion in reviewing unfair labor practice charges and deciding which should and which should not be taken to complaint.
I don't know why courts should worry about the jurisdiction of the labor board then.
Well, I think that the court should worry about it in that instance because the prosecutorial officer of the NLRB has concluded that it will not effectuate the policies of the National Labor Relations Act to prosecute. And the obligation under 8A5 is an obligation which exists for the purpose of fostering collective bargaining and for the purpose of effectuating the policies of that law.
Well, in any event, I take it the General Counsel did not turn down a complaint based on the failure to pay these contributions.
That's correct, Your Honor. Neither the labor unions involved nor the trust funds filed unfair labor practice charges in this case. And indeed, I don't think it comes as any small coincidence the trust fund suits filed in this case were filed exactly one day after the NLRB's statute of limitations expired, such that I'm sure there would be an argument later that it would be impossible to invoke the jurisdiction of the NLRB because the statute had run.
If the court goes ahead, can that same issue of a violation is there a situation in which the court can decide the unfair labor practice matter and then the same issue come before the board? Can that ever happen?
It has happened, Your Honor, and in that instance.
And the board's bound by the court's decision, I presume.
Well, as a matter of fact, I believe that there is some case law that says that the NLRB's determination would ultimately be determinative of the labor law issue. I apologize because the name of the case escapes me, but I know that there is a Supreme Court decision dealing with this where you had a companion federal court case and an NLRB case progressing concurrently. Both of them ended up before the court, and the court said that the NLRB's determination would be determinative of the issue. I believe that the NLRB's findings were to issue a complaint in this case would be collateral estoppel, the collateral estoppel would attach to various findings made by the NLRB were it to have gone on this matter. I don't believe that there would be a similar result were the court to hear this, because I believe the NLRB would have exclusive jurisdiction over it, and the court's findings would be in excess of its authority.
Mr. Ross, will you state for me, because I'm a little fuzzy on it, what is your legal defense to paying these contributions? Why do you contend you are not liable for the contributions for the period since the expiration of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor, we do.
And what is the reason for that position?
Well, there are a number of reasons, Your Honor. First of all, we believe that based on the peculiar facts in this case, there may not be a necessity for an impasse, and that indeed the unions waive whatever rights they had to bargain with us, and we are therefore free to implement changes. In addition to which, assuming that the unions can be found ever to have done anything in furtherance of their bargaining interests, we believe that we would be able to establish the existence of an impasse. And then lastly, and I think this is an important point, and that is that we believe that the duty to bargain under Section 8D is a mutual obligation. That is, it's an obligation that attaches not only to the employer, but it's a duty that attaches to the labor organization. Now, in this instance, we clearly sent a letter to the labor unions and said, we want to bargain with you. We clearly said that we will not adhere to the terms of the collective bargaining agreement that's going to expire on June 15th after it expires. Please bargain with us. They did not. They failed to bargain. And we believe that that constitutes a breach of their duty to bargain. And I think that it speaks, that I think that it is just the kind of thing that this court recognized in the Katz case, where it said that there may be some instances.
The bottom line is, you contend it's not really before, but as a matter of national labor relations law, there is no duty to make contributions. Are your employees continuing to earn benefits under this plan? Are they continuing to work in a way that will make them eligible for larger benefits than if they were not?
I don't know, Your Honor. Can't answer the question. I don't think the case has been fully developed enough to really deal with that issue. I don't know of any instance in which the employees have asserted that they are. I just don't know the answer to that. But I might add that if it turns out that the employers was free or permitted under the facts of this case to cease making these contributions, and certainly the employees could not claim any increased rights or benefits by virtue of the fact that the employer exercised its legitimate rights under the National Labor Relations Act and ceased making payments. So while I understand it's a question that is of some concern to the court, I'm not sure that it's a question that should really affect the court's consideration. I was commenting before on the union's, what we consider to be the union's failure to bargain in this case. And I'd like to refer the Court to the Katz decision, and most specifically to page 748 of that case, where Justice Brennan recognized that there may be circumstances in which the Board could or should accept as excusing or justifying an employer's unilateral action. Now, while we can't know what those circumstances would be, we believe that the facts in this particular case, the fact that the union basically sat on its rights and did nothing to come to the bargaining table was a breach of its duty to bargain. And when you think about it, it makes perfectly good sense from a labor policy standpoint, because an employer's ability to make unilateral changes in that instance actually furthers the collective bargaining process. If an employer is locked in perpetuity into maintaining the status quo because its bargaining partner will not come to the bargaining table, what better force to get that union's attention than to be able to make these unilateral changes such that the union has something to lose. And in this recessionary economy, or the economy where you find employers are negotiating,
whether there's an impasse.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not sure that...
decide when they, after they consult a good labor lawyer.
Well, presumably they'll know when they do that, but I believe that there are a variety of issues here that are labor law issues that really belong with the board and not with the district court, and that these issues should be decided by the board. There are a couple of other points I'd like to touch upon. The trust funds complain that if they're forced to go to the NLRB, they won't receive the statutory relief provided them under Section 502G2, because the board, they say, doesn't have the remedial power, or has only remedial powers, and doesn't have the authority to grant 502-like relief. Now, in our brief, we show the court that there are a number of NLRB decisions in which, if not 502 relief, at least the functional equivalent, or something very similar to 502 relief, has been granted. Besides, the remedies appropriate to Section 515 and 502 collection actions, and that's what they are, collection actions, may not be appropriate for matters of federal labor law and policy. ERISA actions are intended to enforce contractual promises to pay, and it is appropriate that Congress provided for stiff penalties against employers who breach their promises to pay. These are penalties which discourage frivolous contests over what are clear-cut contractual obligations. On the other hand, federal labor policy and issues arising under the National Labor Relations Act are not nearly so clear-cut or simple as mere contractual promises and the breaches of those promises. And I say that because they typically involve a struggle between labor and management and a delicate balancing of their competing interests in a manner that will effectuate federal labor policy. That is what the NLRB is supposed to do. That is what the genesis of the Katz case is, and I believe that is what should be an overriding consideration. Mandatory punitive remedies of ERISA will chill the rights of employers to assert these legitimate interests under the National Labor Relations Act and upset the delicate balance of power struck by Congress and the NLRB through its interpretation of the National Labor Relations Act. Under these circumstances, we believe that it is understandable why Congress limited Section 515 to contractual claims and left Section 8A5, including asserted continuations of trust funds, to the NLRB. We also want to point out that contrary to the trust fund, the funding of plans will not be endangered by submitting Section 8A5 disputes to the NLRB. I venture to say that 99% of the contributions paid to the trust funds are made pursuant to an employer's contractual promise to pay, and it follows, therefore, that the overwhelming majority of actions brought by the trust funds under 515 and 502 involve an employer's breach of its contractual promise and do not involve 8A5 obligations. Giving such claims to the NLRB where they belong will have only a de minimis effect on the plans, while giving full effect to the NLRA and the scheme devised by Congress in passing the National Labor Relations Act.
The fact that the board isn't the least bit worried about interference with its jurisdiction.
Well, Your Honor, I believe, based on some dissents that I've read recently issued by the board, that certain members of the board would like not to have to deal with these problems. But I believe that the statute mandates that they do so, and that they are obliged to fulfill their statutory obligations. And so they must do so, and 515 doesn't alter that result. The trust funds complaints about funding in an 8A5 complaint are also speculative and premature because funds must be entitled to monies before they can claim that they're going to be underfunded. Now, by that I mean that the entitlement to these funds is predicated upon a finding that the employer's actions violate Section 8A5. If there is no 8A5 violation, then the employer is under no obligation to pay under the National Labor Relations Act, and the plans lose nothing. In the final analysis, it is false to portray this case, as the petitioners do, as a case in which the employer obviously owes money and that an adverse decision here will prevent the trust funds from collecting. The employer does not obviously owe money. That is an issue for the NLRB to decide. Further, an adverse decision here will not mean that the trust funds can never collect money. All it means is that they will be required to go to the NLRB where this case should have been brought in the first place.
Has the board taken the position, or the general counsel for the board taken the position, that the NLRB will not entertain these matters?
No, Your Honor. They have not. I just know of one member who has said that he would prefer not to have to deal with these cases.
So as far as we know, they will entertain an unfair labor practice complaint if indeed the union chooses to go that route.
Or if the trust funds choose to go that route, for that matter, Your Honor. Anybody can file an unfair labor practice charge. Any person can, and if you look at the statutory definition of the National Labor Relations Act for a person, it specifically includes trustees. So it's clear by the wording of the statute that Congress contemplated that trustees would be able to implement the NLRB's process. We should give effect to that. The petitioners and the Solicitor General base all of their arguments on policies which emanate, they say, from ERISA, which was intended to ensure the fiscal health of plans. Now, no one can deny, it's like saying you hate apple pie and motherhood, to say that this is not an important end. We agree that that is an important end. However, we don't believe that in implementing or enacting Section 515, Congress intended to reach this far. This is a case of statutory interpretation where Congress has already determined what the policy is. Congress appreciated the difference between contractual obligations and legal obligations imposed purely by federal labor law. In 515, it confined itself to obligations imposed by contract, leaving 8A5 violations and remedies flowing therefrom to be decided by the NLRB. Contrary to the trust funds, this is not a gap or a discontinuity in ERISA's comprehensive scheme, but rather a recognition that contractual obligations and legal obligations are two entirely different duties, emanating from two entirely different statutes, intended to achieve two different but often complementary purposes. Sending 8A5 contribution cases to the board will adequately protect the plan's interests while at the same time effectuate Congress's intent in passing the National Labor Relations Act. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Ross. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until Monday next at 10 o'clock.